That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to Intelligence Squared. This week, we were joined by Nina Schick, who spoke to Carl Miller about her new book, Deepfakes and the Infocalypse, What You Urgently Need to Know. And they had a really fascinating conversation about how the rise of deepfake technology not only threatens our democratic politics, but could also suspend the very trustworthiness of the information we consume and exchange. It's a topic that's set to be discussed much more widely in the months and years to come, and we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hi there, everyone. I'm Carl Miller, an academic and researcher, and I'm here today with Nina Schick, a political advisor, broadcaster, and author of the new book, Deepfakes and the Infocalypse. I think that's how you describe it. An exploration of fake news, AI-generated deepfakes, and the dangerous political consequences of our disinformation age. Welcome, Nina.
Hi, Carl.
So let's begin with staring down the kind of technological black hole that you begin the book with, this staring into the world of deepfakes. What does it look like?
So I came across a deepfake only about 3 years ago when they first, less than 3 years ago, when they first erupted on the internet. And for those who don't know, and many listeners will know, what a deepfake is essentially an AI-generated, either partially or wholly, fake piece of media content. It could be a video, it can be an image, it can also be text. And I came to it as somebody who was advising the former NATO Secretary General, and we were working on election interference and disinformation and what Russia was doing to really disrupt the politics of the Western world. So when I first found a deepfake on this very obscure area of the internet, on Reddit, and its first use was in non-consensual pornography, I was like, oh my goodness, this is huge. Forget about fake news, forget about the disinformation, all the kinds of manipulated media we've seen before. This is the heralding of what's to come, when you can actually fake video and make it look like it's the real deal. So immediately when I kind of came across it in pornography, I was like, this is gonna have massive implications on everything from politics to also individuals. And I kind of lay that out in the book, but there is the first kind of introduction as to like what a deepfake actually is.
And so most people thinking about disinformation, probably in their mind's eye, will recall maybe some dodgy tweets or a Facebook post. But you're kind of sounding the alarm, not about textual information, but about the world of video and pictures and the things that we actually see that seem so visceral to us.
Absolutely. So I think when I first came to deepfakes, I recognized how potent they were, because in our current information ecosystem, right, which is like changing so quickly, video has become the medium of communication. And if you look at how it's changed over the last 30 years, we first had the internet, then we had smartphones, then we have social media. And I come from a part of the world, Nepal, you know, part of the developing world, where until recently, people were just kind of completely disconnected from this information ecosystem. But now everybody has a smartphone and everybody consumes information mostly through video. If you look at the stats for next year, I think it's over 82% of global internet traffic is going to be through the consumption of video content. So just at this time, then video is becoming the most important medium of human communication, which is going to reach parts of the globe in a way that no other form of human communication has ever done before. That is just the time when it can be subverted by AI. I should point out that when I talk about deepfakes, it's essentially what I describe as a malicious use of synthetic media being AI generated content. And there'll be loads of positive use cases. I mean, it's completely going to open up like the creative industries and advertising industries, but there will be bad use cases. If I told you, hey, if you're a criminal or you want to do some kind of political disinformation and you have the power to make any video or audio, any media of anyone saying or doing anything, you can see how that technology can quickly be used by the bad guys. And I think what I wanted to do with this book, the hook was the deep fake, because I thought, wow, that's so fascinating when I first came across them. But increasingly, as I started writing the book, I was like, well, there's something else going on here. And that is that our information ecosystem in the age of information has just become so dangerous and untrustworthy. And I think a part of that is because it has changed so exponentially with these advances that I've just described, from internet to social media, to smartphones, to the coming age of AI, that society simply hasn't had time to adjust. And if you look at kind of the big changes in the ways that humans have communicated, from the printing press to photography, I mean, there were 400 years between that, right? From the invention of Gutenberg's printing press to the advent of modern photography. And I just don't think we're ready for what AI can do. I'm not saying technology is bad, I'm just saying it will have bad use cases. And my first thing that I wanted to do with writing this book is to talk about that, so people recognize it's not only coming, it's already here, and we need to be able to recognize it.
And boiling down deepfakes, just so that people know, so in very, very concrete terms, what do they let people do? Create any video looking like anyone that people want, which is entirely synthetic.
So a deepfake is essentially a maliciously used piece of synthetic media. So a synthetic media is either wholly generated by AI or partially generated by AI. And we're still at the very, very beginning of the synthetic media revolution. So what we've seen so far with deepfakes, and a lot of people who talk about deepfakes are like, oh my God, this is the end of democracy. It can make you say or do, make you take anyone or say or do anything. But the reality is the barriers to entry right now are still quite high. However, they're coming down very, very quickly. So essentially what that means is that Hollywood level special effects, you know, the type of things that you see in these blockbusters, which would previously have been inaccessible to anyone except those with a lot of money, you know, a whole special effects studio, that is basically going to become something that anybody can create or do. And the reason why they are dangerous or can be used dangerously is because of the AI element of it. And this is where I kind of like go into the anecdotes in my story, where you can take content of anyone. So I can take your personal information and then create a deep fake of you, either in a video form, or I can steal your voice and I can make you say something with audio. And like I mentioned, this only started really coming about 3 years ago, and it's already getting to the point where it's quite advanced. And in the next kind of 18 to 12 months, the barriers to entry are going to come down even further. So it's next level disinformation, but this is not only in the domain of high geopolitics or you know, the information war between China and Russia and the United States. This is something that's going to impact people in their very personal lives. It's something, it's a technology that already is and will continue to be misused by criminals. It's a technology that can be used by somebody who has a grudge against you, for example, by making, as we've already been seeing, revenge porn. So this is something that really has the possibility to impact everyone, not only on the level of the political, but even in our most personal lives.
And is this kind of all of that together? Is that the infocalypse? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, the infocalypse. It's just a nice word that I decided to kind of throw into the title. It was actually a word that was coined by a US technologist in 2016 when he was kind of warning of the era of fake news. And essentially how I describe the infocalypse is our increasingly dangerous information ecosystem that's untrustworthy. And it's something that I think is going to continue to become more dangerous and more untrustworthy. So the infocalypse, I think, is going to advance. And within that, I think AI and deepfakes are going to definitely play a role. So I think the main point, and this is what researchers like you also are thinking about, Carl, is how do we change the infrastructure of our information ecosystem as to make it more trustworthy and safe? Because it is so important, becoming ever more important.
Well, there's lots of kind of stops that we might take on our tour through the infocalypse over the next 40 minutes or so. But let's begin with, I think, perhaps the most obvious, the one foregrounded very recently in a big report in Parliament. We've been talking about this for years, Russia. Zoom us into one of these operations that Russia has mounted. What does it actually look like when you begin to kind of tear it apart and kind of look at the innards?
Yeah, so I mean, my background is somebody who has started working in like national security and European politics for about 10 years. And I was really at the front lines of watching what was happening when Russia annexed Crimea and also then invaded Eastern Ukraine in 2013. And the really interesting thing about Russia is that I have a whole chapter in my book on Russia because I call Russia the master. I say they are the masters of information warfare, and it's not just something that they started doing in the infocalypse, right? They were doing this in the Cold War. And I recount a story in my book about how successful they were at spreading disinformation. And consistently throughout history, they have used disinformation and information operations to have an outsized geopolitical influence. So if you look back at the Cold War, one of the most daring disinformation campaigns the Soviets ever launched was called Operation Infection. Now, this was the myth that HIV/AIDS was a virus created by the CIA in a laboratory to kill African Americans. And in the 80s, this seed of disinformation that the Soviets came up with was kind of planted in a newspaper in India. And then over the years, it was like reiterated in the Soviet press, and it kind of grew and grew and grew and grew until about almost a decade later, it went completely viral. Now, in the infocalypse with modern technology, Russia still has more or less the same strategy. It's just that the tools by which to spread this kind of disinformation have become far more potent. So if we fast forward, I kind of do a little tour of what the Russians did in 2016, because I was working on these political events then. If you look at what happened in the election, one of the things they did, apart from hacking and also trying to compromise the critical voting infrastructure, one of the things that they did, which was super interesting, was social media operations. And this is something that they had become really good at in the Ukrainian war. So they really cut their teeth in about 2013, 2014. And then they started looking at the US, not only in 2016, but for a period of 3 years, they started kind of looking at the US in 2013. And what they did was really find a way where they could attack Western democracy from within. And the tactic to do this was to cause division within society. And what they did was create these communities on social media by using Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, where they built up people's tribal identities on both sides of the political spectrum. So it's wrong to think that Russian disinformation just targets one side, either the left or the right of the political spectrum. And they injected these groups with a lot of pride. So for instance, it could be Confederates, you know, Texas secessionists, gun owners on the right, on the conservative side of the spectrum. And on the other side of the spectrum, it was African-American groups, you know, feminists. And then after they had kind of built up these groups, loads of feelings of pride, a distinct identity, they started injecting them with messages of legitimate political grievances. And it was so dastardly. One of the things that I document in the book is how time and time again, Russian disinformation, starting with Operation Infection, has focused on the African American community. And they did that in 2016 as well, where they used Facebook to build up all these Black Lives Matter groups around some of the controversial shootings and police brutality. But at the same time, they were also creating these Blue Lives Matter groups where they were talking about, you know, we need to protect our police and we can't defund the police. And it was so ironic because as I was writing the book, I mean, I wrote it in a few weeks during lockdown, that's when, just at the end, when we were going to press, I'd warned how this would continue to be an issue that the Russians would agitate on. That's when the George Floyd killing happened. And that's not to say that everything that's happened since in America is because of the Russians, because there is a long history of complicated race relations, but it is prime picking ground. And it is such an opportunity for them to cause these divisions in society. And the interesting thing that they're doing in 2020, so the methods keep evolving and they keep on becoming more sophisticated. And in 2020, what we have discovered the Russians are doing vis-a-vis the election in the United States is now they've kind of outsourced their troll farms, which they had in St. Petersburg in 2016, to Africa, where in Ghana, they had an NGO which was set up to ostensibly be a legitimate human rights NGO. And the people that were working there were actually running these social media influence operations to divide the United States ahead of the election. So the point is, information warfare is an old game, but it's becoming more and more potent. And with these new tools, it's becoming more and more dangerous. We see it in our polarized politics. It's not only because of the Russians, it's not only because of the Chinese, but it's something where we as democracies are very vulnerable. And the other important point is that Russia has been so successful in these information operations, is that other countries are now looking to Russia and seeking to emulate what they're doing. So one very interesting thing that I go into the book, and maybe we'll come into that, is how China has increasingly been playing these games, especially in light of COVID, given the geopolitical consequences for China vis-a-vis COVID.
I mean, that particular case kind of exposes a tactic I've always been fascinated by and always worry that most people really kind of don't quite grasp, which is the way that a state can squat on kind of one side and then the other side of a political spectrum. I think we often kind of think that disinformation operations are all about, you know, making Brexit happen or making Trump win, you know, trying to force a particular outcome, but not actually that they're on both sides arguing for both things at the same time, trying to make everyone angrier.
Absolutely. And that is so key, because, and I think you're so right to point that out, because over the past few weeks, when the Russia issue has come to the fore in the news agenda here in the UK again, I've had so many people come to me and say, well, it can't possibly be, because in 2016, they were supposedly in favor of Brexit. And now, you know, oh, they were supposedly in favor of Jeremy Corbyn. But that is exactly the strategy. You cause a division and chaos, and you hit a democracy where it hurts, you know, because of our freedom of speech and our freedom of expression. You seek to drive the rifts into democracy on all sides of the spectrum. They did it here in the UK with regards to both the Conservatives and Labour. And you're absolutely right, in the United States in 2016, they did it for both Donald Trump as well as Bernie Sanders. So it works on both sides.
The next question I have for you, Nina, is a difficult one. It's an important one, but a difficult one. I get asked it all the time. And it's that big question which has proven very, very difficult to kind of get around and to therefore kind of get real serious resources and political will mobilized against this problem. And the question is, does any of this actually matter? How do we measure the impact of this? You know, isn't this just social media advertising? And does that actually work at all? You know, does any of this really shift anyone's minds or beliefs in any way?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And my answer would be it absolutely matters, because that, if we're looking at it from the dimension of foreign interference, right? So if you say to me, oh, well, it's lazy to say that Trump won because of the Russians, I would agree with you. I'd say absolutely. You know, that is a lazy explanation for a very complicated set of reasons as to why Trump won the election. And it isn't only because the Russians intervened. However, the fact that the Russians did intervene is a fact. So that is something we cannot deny and we shouldn't deny. Moreover, it's not just about foreign interference, right? It's not just about what the Russians are doing, what the Chinese are doing, what the Saudis are doing. They're doing it. Okay, that's one angle. The second angle is that this corroded and corrupted information ecosystem is increasingly coming to define our own domestic politics as well. So if you look at it from the political angle, I mean, really what's at stake here is liberal democracy, right? Do you want to have a liberal democracy in a kind of functioning society? Because if you do, you need to have some kind of basis, some kind of shared reality, some kind of objective platform on which to decide these are the facts and this is how we're going to run society. So it doesn't work if it's being disrupted by foreign powers from the outside and internally from by domestic agents as well. So if you end up in this state where you're just constantly having information warfare, because that is literally what it is, then our society is going to suffer. So let's say you're not interested in any of that and you don't care about what the Russians are doing, what the Chinese are doing, and you don't care about like domestic politics either. I would say, again, it matters because it impacts all of us in other ways. First of all, businesses. Every business is at risk in the infocalypse. Every business faces reputational risk. Every business can be subjected to disinformation. I mean, we're already seeing it. How, you know, on social media, these campaigns have been run saying this and this business supported Trump, so boycott them, or saying, you know, there was another instance where there was a lot of fake news about Starbucks giving free coffees to people of color. Every business is at risk of disinformation in this corrupt and dangerous information ecosystem. Aside from business, then there's also you, the personal, when it comes to the very individual level. And because of the way that deepfakes and AI will make disinformation basically a tool that's available to anyone, you yourself are at the front lines of potentially becoming a target of disinformation in a really, really personal way. Because what deepfakes will allow you to do, or will allow a bad actor to do, is to actually steal your voice or to steal your face and to make you say or do something you didn't say. And again, the first instance, it's not make-believe, right? It's already happening. It's happening in pornography. It's happening mostly against women right now. But that is a harbinger of what's to come. Because let's say I just don't like you, Carl, and I want to ruin your reputation. I could make a leaked audio tape of you saying something very disagreeable, which would be enough to get you canceled in these political climates. And I could just put that on Google with your name on it, and that would be the first thing that comes up. And you could try to...
You don't want to give anyone any ideas, Nina. Yeah, yeah.
You could try to explain that to a potential employer and say, oh, you know, that wasn't me, that's a deep fake, but they might just say, you know what, it's just too complicated. And so it matters for our politics, both domestically and geopolitically. It matters for every single business, and it matters in your personal life. And this is why I think it's not just a question of deep fakes. It's much bigger than that. It's about how is our information ecosystem become so dangerous? How are we facing this monumental crisis of mis and disinformation where we've all become potential targets? And what the hell do we do about it? So it absolutely matters.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
All right, well, thank you for that extremely powerful response to that difficult question. Let's pull away from the Russia station on our grand tour and go to somewhere you've already mentioned, domestic politics. So in exactly what way do you think have domestic politicians or campaigns kind of looked at the Russia example and then kind of drawn lessons from that about the way that they were going to wage politics in the digital age?
Well, I think the interesting thing about politics in the digital age is the imperative just to win? You know, is anything allowed when it comes to winning? So can you say and do anything? Or is the imperative, especially in Western democracies, to win, but also to have some kind of cohesive society? And I think that's kind of the crossroads where we stand at right now. And in my book, when I look at the Western democracies and the domestic threat and the domestic challenge, I use the United States as a case study, because obviously we have the US election coming up. And I look at particularly one actor who's got so much influence, and of course that's Donald Trump. And I know so much has been written about Donald Trump and so much has been said about Donald Trump, but I think it's worth retreading that ground, because he is the leader of the free world, and where America leads, you know, the rest of the Western world will follow. And seeing how fast and loose he has been with not only lying, but also disinformation and the use of manipulated media, including the use of deepfakes, has been really alarming, because to a certain extent, it doesn't matter whether or not Trump wins the election in 2020. That precedent has already been set. So I'm really interested to see if Trump loses, you know, what happens then? What happens to the infocalypse? What happens to the information ecosystem? Because it's not just the Republicans who are using these tactics, the Democrats are too. And I talk about that in my book. This is the perennial kind of debate, you know, where the Democrats have been like, oh, well, if the Republicans use these kind of disinformation tactics, then should we do it too? Or does that make us just as bad? And the reality is they have used these kind of tactics. There was a famous instance where there was a seat in Alabama, and the Democrats ran a disinformation campaign inspired by the Russians against the very safe Republican candidates who were supposed to win that seat. So I just think the main question is, what happens with our domestic information ecosystem? And is it just going to become one where anything goes in order to win? And we see those kind of divides here in the UK as well, right? Where everything has become so polarized, where you have to choose a side, and any kind of nuance or any kind of position, you know, being a centrist is way outdated. So I think this is...
Right, 1996, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Centrism. This is one of the biggest challenges facing Western democracies, in my view. It's true that we are facing a lot of, geopolitically, we're facing a lot of hostile forces and the world is changing. However, I don't think we've quite, as a democracy, figured out how we're going to run our politics in the information age, because we do have certain rights, freedom of expression, freedom of information, which are inalienable and should be protected. However, we haven't quite figured out how to square that with the dangerous information ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way, as you describe, you know, that these techniques have been imported into domestic politics that makes me so nervous, that whilst it kind of remained in the hands of Russia, you know, at least the techniques were kind of shadowy and kind of felt illegitimate, you know, the intelligence agencies might be trying to interfere, but at least we could kind of know that was wrong and try and stop it. But it kind of, it begins to feel like actually they're just like baked in campaigning tactics. They become kind of ethically normalized, where people can't even really see a moral problem in using them. And I mean, it really makes me recall the last Indian election, where I believe every single mainstream party in India was each caught by Facebook and the other tech giants in an illicit influence campaign. All of them.
All of them.
Kind of implied that it was just now a campaigning tactic, that it's kind of embarrassing if you don't do it.
Yeah, and that all evidence, you're absolutely right, all evidence seems to suggest that that is the new normal. I mean, these researchers at the University of Oxford, who've been kind of tracking, they call it computational propaganda and influence operations on social media, found that, you know, the number of countries doing it had gone up to 70, I think it was last year, from 17 a few years ago, and that included many Western countries. So I think the genie's already out of the bottle, right? I don't think we're putting it back in. So I think the question then is, how do we as citizens feel about that, especially in Western democracies? And how do we think that is going to impact our politics? Because it definitely will impact our politics, especially in these countries where the state does not have a monopoly over the information ecosystem, like, for example, in China. So it really can be a case of too much information having the effect of censorship, which is not exactly how you would think of it when you think an abundance of information would be a good thing rather than a bad thing. But if it's an abundance of bad information, what are we going to do about it? And these are really the big questions that we need to think about. And I honestly think these are the biggest and most important challenges for our democracies in the 21st century and in the next 5 to 10 years.
We are going to get to solutions. I promise everyone I'm not going to leave us in this morass of despair. But I think there is one further stop we need to go to in terms of diagnosing the problem. And it's that stop that we tend to kind of talk less about, kind of influence operations happening elsewhere. I mean, here in the West, of course, we're obsessed by US politics, so we talk about that all the time. We're obsessed by Brexit and British politics, we talk about that all the time. What does kind of information warfare look outside of the West? What is it like in Saudi Arabia or Nepal or India, in fact? You know, places that we just have less, you know, we just talk about less on a daily basis.
So this was one of the most interesting chapters in the book for me to research and write, because obviously I came at it from the angle of like Western democracies and foreign countries trying to undermine Western democracies through information warfare. But what was also really interesting to look at was, you know, the rest of the world. And of course, the dangerous information ecosystem impacts the rest of the world as well, which is one of the reasons why I think what happens in the West is so important, because if we as a kind of bastion of the free world can't deal with this bad information ecosystem, with all the institutions and all the protections that we have in place, and we do, then there is no hope for those countries which have less rigid safeguards. And I kind of go into a little bit about, I grew up in South Asia, I grew up in Nepal and India, and I go into how the Infocalypse has been super dangerous in parts of the world like India, where misinformation and disinformation has been rife on these new kind of, as this people have plugged into this new information ecosystem with tools like the internet and smartphones for the first time, how they've been less able to deal with some of the disinformation that's gone viral. And I give some instances about how in India, there's been like numerous cases of people being killed because of viral misinformation spreading on WhatsApp, for example. There was also the case of Burma, where there was literally an ethnic genocide against the Rohingya, which was very much fanned on by online disinformation, which was spread in the case of Burma, actually hate speech, very much on Facebook, right? So online. It's fascinating to me when I go back to Nepal and I see people who in the village, you know, barely 10 years ago had running, well, they still don't have running water or electricity, but they will have a mobile phone and be able to get on the internet. So a lot of the people in the developing world, for lack of a better word, who are first coming into this information ecosystem have less protection than we do in the West, because at least in the West, we have some form of inoculation and we understand that this is underway. And we also have learned, because we've seen some of the more crude and rudimentary forms of disinformation and misinformation, and we can recognize them, right? We've been inoculated against the worst, some of the dangers. And in part, I'm writing this book because I want to help inoculate against the coming danger of deepfake. But in parts of the developing world, that doesn't exist yet. So not only can these tools be used as a form of kind of oppressing human rights and for real violence. And I mean, we've literally seen it in the case of ethnic genocide. It's a place in many parts of the world. I fear that the citizenry is simply not ready for the Infocalypse, where it could do a lot more damage. So again, I think we have a responsibility to build a safer information environment for all these people who are going to be let out into the wild, wild west and potentially be harmed by what's out there.
I suppose that they are two very stark reminders of what the consequences possibly can be, you know, sometimes literally death and destruction and genocide, as very tangible reminders to anyone with lingering doubts as to the significance of this problem.
I wanted to quickly also mention is there's something called the liar's dividend. So with deep fakes, and this is one really interesting thing that's happening with deep fakes. So just the fact that you have this technology out there where you know you can fake video evidence means that for in certain parts of the world where there's already kind of a fragile consensus around human rights abuses and video is seen as a form of documenting that, the mere existence of deepfakes hurts them in the other way, by meaning that everybody gets plausible deniability. So let's say you have a video evidence of someone committing an atrocity. Because deepfakes exist now, you can say, well, that's just a deep fake, even when it isn't. And I kind of talk about in the book how that happened, for example, in Gabon, where there was a failed coup d'etat because the prime minister kind of went missing for a few months. And it was because he had a stroke. But when he appeared on TV, he looked kind of strange because he had the stroke and he had like Botox to make his face look a bit more straight. And what his opponent said was that was a deep fake video and that wasn't actually the president, and the president had died and they used that as an opportunity to have a coup d'etat. So even if there isn't a deep fake, the fact that there is no more consensus around visual media serving as legitimate evidence can have an impact in the other way as well.
Okay. So there's one more stop we need to get to before we get to the solution. So I think we've began to diagnose a problem and get a hand around how this happens, where it happens, why. I want to talk blame, Nina. Who is to blame for this? You've mentioned quite a few times this kind of corrupted or broken information ecosystem. Who is responsible for building that? And what have they done to make it so vulnerable to the kinds of campaigns we've been talking about today?
Yeah, you know what? I wish I could tell you this is the person who is to blame, but I think a lot of this has come about by, you know, the tech utopia. So the tech utopia that the age of information was supposed to bring, we've already seen there are many, many downsides as well. I mean, technology itself is net neutral, right? It's just a driver of human intention, and human intention is neither wholly good nor wholly bad. So the kind of tech revolution or the age of information of the last three decades is now manifesting itself in both its amazing aspect as well its very, very, very dark aspect. So I don't think that there is one person to blame. However, what I will say is that we should not be so naive as to think that the new developments that are coming down the line. So for example, when it comes to the advances in AI, which is what I'm talking about here in particular with regards to deepfake, that is not going to be used by bad guys. You know, it's going to have incredible applications. Of course it will. But we should not be so naive as to think that there won't be opportunists who will use it for bad. So whether that's a rogue state, whether that's an opportunist domestic politician, whether that is a criminal, whether that's a fraudster, whether that's just your mate who you really pissed off who wants to get some form of revenge on you. I think this, more than having one person to blame, is the ultimate is ultimately a reflection on human nature, right? Because all this technology which is coming together with human nature is showing both the best sides and the worst sides of humanity. And I think the only thing that we have to do right now is we need to get a little bit of a handle on some of the bad sides.
And how we do that? This is the final stop. Here we are. How do we tell me this is fixable?
Yeah.
Tell me that the information age is not going to be one where information is more corrupted and corruptive than ever before. Tell me that there's a way through.
I think there is a way through. But unfortunately, there is no silver bullet answer. And because we are going to be entering now a period of tremendous flux, both geopolitically, not to mention because of the huge kind of exponential advances in technology and how that's going to impact our society, I think there's going to be a lot more chaos before there is structure and calm again. So I think in the first instance, what we need to do is to name it and understand what's happening. And that was my contribution in writing this book, because I kind of saw all of these trends and how they were coming together over the last decade of my work, where I started with what Russia was doing. And then I saw how, you know, kind of some of the Western influence operation campaigns were running, and what was happening with Brexit, what was happening around Trump, what was an increasingly polarized debate in our own society. And then I saw how women were being targeted by deepfake non-consensual pornography. I think the first thing is to put a conceptual framework around that. And that's what I've called infocalypse, right? This information ecosystem, which is increasingly dangerous and untrustworthy. We all are impacted by it. I mean, you raised the point earlier in the interview, and I think this is something that many people ask me, saying, well, you know, why does it matter? It's just a bit of nonsense, because it's not tangible. So I think we need to, first of all, stress how important it is and how it impacts all of us. And then the second part, so that's the first thing, understand. The second part is we begin to defend more proactively and there is no one organization or one body that can do that. You know, it's not, the answers are not going to come from regulation alone. They're not going to come from policymakers alone. You can't just go to the big tech companies and be like, you fix it, because it is ultimately not a tech problem. It's a societal problem. It's a human nature problem. And we all, these contingent parts of society, need to work together to come up with solutions. So you need to take a networked approach. Obviously, that is pretty complicated, but the good work has already started. And in the kind of last chapter of my book, I lay out various people and organizations that are tackling different parts of the problem. So you have technologists who are trying to create AI, machine learning systems that can identify deepfakes online. And then you have people who are taking more of a human rights angle. And then you have people who are, you know, looking at the policy and legal arenas. I think it's not, again, it's not something that's going to be fixed overnight. It's not something that's going to be fixed by one body. It's only something that when society recognizes how much this impacts everything, that society as a whole has to mobilize and, well, do something about our corrupt information ecosystem in the information age.
And are we mobilizing? I mean, are you optimistic? Like, is what should be happening happening now?
I think it will probably get worse before it gets better. But I think there will be a tipping point where there are more and more resources dedicated to this. I mean, if I was in charge of the government, for example, I wouldn't have, you know, tech as like a subsection of what government looks at. I mean, it should be above everything, you know, it should. And unfortunately, I can only speak from my experience of working in the policy and politics world, where I have found too large of a gap between the understanding of policymakers and politicians and the scale of the problem. So I can only speak from that perspective, where I have seen a lot more work needs to be done. But the good thing is that there are people who really, really get it. People like you as well, Carl. We need more Carl Millers in the world, who are trying to bridge that gap. And I think there will be a moment when we truly understand that this is probably one of the biggest challenges of the information age. And I'm, you know, of course it is. We're living in the information age, and there's a bad and dangerous information ecosystem. We need to fix it. And I'm hopeful that we will be mobilizing towards that.
Well, there we go, everyone. We've reached the end of our tour through the Infocalypse. Thank you so much, Nina. Thank you to Intelligent Squared. And of course, thank you to all of you for listening or watching this. If you do want to find out more about deepfakes and the Infocalypse, you can via the link in the podcast description below. But it leaves me only to say to you, Nina, thank you so much one more time. And I hope this is a word, even if I can't pronounce it always, that we'll be talking about a lot more in the future.
Thank you.